Good morning. Thanks for joining us. We're going to get started. My name is Phil Cusick. I cover the telecom and cable space here at J.P. Morgan. I want to welcome Randall Stephenson, the President, Chairman, and CEO of AT&T. For those who don't know Randall, he's been the Chairman and CEO of AT&T since 2007. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Nice to see you. Maybe we just start in a big general sort of fashion. What are your big priorities for the rest of this year?
Sure. If I could, before I do it, can I cover my lawyer's bases and put up a safe harbor up here? Statement could include forward-looking statements, and you can get details out on our website. Priorities for this year. So we've been pretty consistent in saying what we're about. We're trying to create what we think is going to be a very unique customer experience, and it's a customer experience that we're committed to building around premium entertainment. And so everything we're about is building a premium entertainment experience and then incorporating into that the connectivity, whether it be mobile, broadband, TV. And obviously the launching pad for going down this path was the DirecTV deal. And it's proven to be really important in terms of where we're headed, because with DirecTV, we got 25 million premium TV subscribers. But most importantly is it gave us a platform to go out and negotiate rights for all of that content, so that all these customers can take the content now out of their living room and they're able to consume it on all their devices, whether it's a smartphone, tablet, or whatever. And the engagement on this content has been impressive. I mean, very quickly, we shot to half of our customers were engaging routinely on their smartphone on this content. And so then that kind of gave us the ability to move forward one step further and then go get the rights for the over-the-top delivery of this. So even if you're not a premium subscriber of DirecTV, we got the rights to deliver this to a mobile environment. And so that gave us the ability to launch DirecTV Now. And, you know, we launched this thing back in December, and it was supposed to be a soft launch. Did it with no promotion, no advertisement, don't even hardly pay the reps to sell it, and the thing just caught fire. We put 200,000 subscribers up in December, which was much faster than we were wanting to go, and so we've kind of pulled back. But the reality was that the demand for premium content integrated with the mobile experience was really, really high, which gave us the conviction that we probably ought to just go ahead and go the full distance and just own a position in premium content. And because DirecTV gave us great access to premium content, not owning it limits what you can do. Can you curate the content uniquely for a mobile environment? Can you create new ad-supported models for a mobile environment? And those are the things that were just going to be slow and a long time coming. And so we did the Time Warner deal, excuse me. And Time Warner changes the game. I mean, we now have the ability, and we're actually putting in place plans now to begin curating Time Warner content uniquely for a mobile environment. You can think of all the great franchises in Time Warner and what we'll be able to do. And we're now working to stand up ad-supported models with the Time Warner content and where that takes us. And so we're really excited about bringing a premium content ownership into our mobile experience and doing some fun things. Now, as you think about this, you better get yourself comfortable that you have the capacity in a mobile environment to accommodate this kind of delivery of premium content. We have been working hard, and in terms of capacity, we really like where we are. We have, I would represent, the best fiber footprint in the country. And I'm talking last-mile fiber, so fiber to the home, building out 12.5 million homes. We're passing 6 million business locations today. Fiber to the cell site, I mean, we're positioned perfectly for delivering fiber to a very dense cell grid, particularly in a world of 5G and so forth. So great fiber footprint. In terms of cell site density, if you will, you need a cell grid that's really dense in a world of premium content delivery, video delivery. What has been, some could say, a problem in terms of having a significant cell site position has become an advantage in the new world. And so really dense cell site grid, we like where we are there. We feel like we can check that off. In terms of a spectrum position, which is what everybody is really working hard to position themselves for, we have pieced together 40 megahertz of depth of both low and high band spectrum that is fallow and waiting to be put to use. And Then we did the FirstNet deal. We won the FirstNet bid, and it came with it 20 megahertz of nationwide premium spectrum as well. So we now have 60 megahertz of fallow spectrum waiting to be put to work to accommodate this kind of video traffic. And so from a capacity standpoint, we think we're in a unique position, and particularly as you think about where is the real capacity gain, it's going to be in a world of 5G and moving into fifth-generation wireless networks. We're talking about deploying networks in the millimeter wave spectrum, and deploying 5G is going to require fiber, cell site density, and millimeter wave spectrum. We are working on the approval of the fiber tower deal, which we signed. The fiber tower deal gives us millimeter wave spectrum, 400 megahertz of depth nationwide, and so we've got really good runway to deploy 5G and have capacity to accommodate that for the next few years. We'll be looking, whether it be government auctions in 2018, secondary market transactions, to continue to enhance that position. But we've got a really good position to begin deploying nationwide a 5G footprint as we get the standards, the technology, and the equipment in place. So like where we are, like the spectrum position, like our capacity position, premium content position, so priorities. Get the Time Warner deal closed. That's priority number one, and spending most of our waking hours on that right now. The second is, and this is, it's a huge driver in terms of creating value from Time Warner, is get the ad-supported model stood up and making sure that we have the capability to take the unique viewer information we have out of our DirecTV and our mobile subscriber environment and make that data accessible, usable for driving ad-supported models within the Time Warner Media and Entertainment Company. And then third, and this one is taking a lot of time and attention right now, it's going to be really, really important, is this FirstNet bid. Standing up FirstNet. We have to have state proposals in front of them. States begin opting into FirstNet here in the next 30 to 45 days. And we're really anxious to get going on building this network because the 60 megahertz of spectrum, what we're really excited about is as you build this network for first responders, we're going to have to climb every cell site. And while you're up on the cell tower, you can assume we'll be lighting up all of this spectrum. So we're basically going to be pre-provisioning a significant amount of capacity as we deploy FirstNet. Not only that, we're going to get a huge performance upgrade as we deploy all this spectrum and bring carrier aggregation to play. And so those three things we'll be executing on heavily over the next 12 months.
And to clarify, that 60 megahertz is what, a 60% increase from everything you have deployed today?
Roughly, yeah. Yeah, I use 50% as a rule of thumb, but it's a little higher than 50%, yeah.
Right. So let's dig in a little bit to the content and distribution business.
Yeah.
How does adding a content business drive revenue growth opportunities in the distribution side?
Actually, it's the right question. I think of it both ways, right? How can a massive scale distribution business, distribution through broadband, distribution through pay TV, distribution through your mobility business, how can that enhance the value of a media and entertainment company, and then vice versa? And how can you drive value out of a media and entertainment company into the distribution business? And I get really enthusiastic as I think about distribution affecting media and entertainment, because the easiest place, and I would say the quickest benefits, will come from the idea that Time Warner, through Turner Networks primarily, has a massive inventory of advertising. Think about Turner Networks and how many what their ad inventory looks like in there. It's like 750 billion plus impressions per year. On the AT&T side, through DirecTV primarily, but also through our mobile business, we have 150 to 200 billion impressions per year. On the AT&T side, we monetize those impressions at a significantly higher yield than your typical media company. And why is that? Because on the DirecTV side and our mobility side, we are very targeted in how we deliver advertising. And we have a significant amount of unique viewership data on our customers. And by virtue of targeting, using addressable advertising, and even getting cross-platform, device-specific, set-top box-specific, targeting advertising, we're getting revenues per impression that are not percentages higher than a traditional media company. They're orders of magnitude higher, 2 and 3 times higher than what you're getting in a traditional media company. To what extent can this information and data and these viewership patterns influence and drive these higher yields on the 750 billion impressions that are within Time Warner and Turner Network specifically? We think it's significant. And even if you can only get percentage increases, it's a big number. You put the two companies together, it's bordering on 1 trillion impressions per year that are going to be able to monetize. So we think we can drive the yields on the media and entertainment businesses, advertising inventory, up significantly. To the extent you believe that and you're convicted of it, and we are, both we and the Time Warner folks are very convinced that we can have a significant impact here. To the extent you drive those yields higher, that's great. That can flow to the bottom line. Or you can take some of that and reinvest it back into differentiating the content that you're creating in Time Warner. Well, what do I mean by that? Can you generate higher yields, create higher revenues, reinvest some of it to drive the ad load down in the Time Warner content? If you can drive ad load down, now you can begin to differentiate your content vis-a-vis other media companies and so forth. So that, we think, is a really exciting opportunity to improve the viewership experience of people on Time Warner content, everything from sports to premium entertainment that you get in TNT and TBS. So those are two really exciting opportunities. The other is, to what extent do you believe this data out of a large-scale distribution business can influence content creation decisions, content selection decisions within a media company? Can you be better informed, and does it enhance your risk management of investment in specific content in a media company? And we're very optimistic about this, that this can truly begin to have an impact on the ROIs in a Time Warner portfolio of content and where you're green lighting shows and movies and so forth. So those are great. And then the other big one that's kind of interesting to think about is all the IP within Time Warner, franchises, if you will, whether it's DC Comics or whether it's Harry Potter or even some of the old stuff like Looney Tunes and so forth. To what extent can you cross-promote these franchises into a large-scale distribution, whether it's in your retail stores, whether it's in your distribution through the paid TV and so forth? What things can you do to cross-promote these franchises and do some unique things with those within your distribution business? So those are kind of just big areas that we're convinced there'll be some early payoffs and opportunities to create value in the media company. How can a media company drive value into a distribution company? Similar question, but a very different answer. So you have to believe that you can somehow drive up ARPU, improve the revenue per customer in the distribution business, or you can increase customer retention, or can you actually use it for market share advantages? And so what are the things you can do? And I go back to, if you own the largest news gathering organization in the world, can you begin to create quickly, innovate quickly, news feeds, for example, that feed into your mobile environment uniquely? I mean, these are things that aren't, you know, new rocket science. These are things that can be done and turned quickly. So you can create unique experiences out of news feeds, as an example. Can you begin to do things with premium content in terms of curating it uniquely for a mobile environment? I'll cause Plepler at HBO to panic when I say this, but can you begin to think about things like Game of Thrones as an example, where in a mobile environment, a 60-minute episode may not be the best experience? Should you think about 20-minute episodes? And can you begin to curate the content? Let the content geniuses and creative geniuses think about this, but curate the content uniquely for a mobile environment. Can you take a Warner Brothers, the massive library of content, it's huge. Can you begin to put ad-supported models around the Warner Brothers content? You have a great direct-to-consumer platform in DirecTV Now. Go direct to consumer with an ad-supported model and begin to generate opportunities through that medium as well. So, you know, I can go on, but there are so many opportunities then to drive value back into your distribution business by uniquely curating content and so forth, ad-supported models that, I mean, we could have that discussion for a long time, but there are a lot of opportunities going both ways.
Okay. And the trade-off of selling out content to as many people as you can versus differentiating the DirecTV and the AT&T business. How do you think about that?
Well, you create value in a media and entertainment company with broad deep distribution. So that's criterion one, and you will always look to create broad and deep distribution in the media and entertainment business. And so nothing is going to change if you're, you know, thinking about Time Warner content, HBO content. You want HBO on every device in the United States and in Latin America and in Europe and in Asia. I mean, that's really, really critical. We actually think there's an opportunity to accelerate the HBO platform in a mobile environment. So nothing changes there. The things that you'll look to do, though, is how can you, I said this a moment ago, but how can you curate the content uniquely for your experience? Can you do some different things with the content that make it more conducive to consumption in a mobile environment? And the example of CNN is a classic example. And can you also surround some of the content with very unique and different ad-supported models? And to the extent that you can do those, then you can create value and drive value into the distribution business as well. But you can't think about, you know, taking Game of Thrones and you're only going to make it available to AT&T customers. That's crazy. You destroy the value of the media and entertainment business. But can you do things, and would you do things uniquely with Game of Thrones, you know, for your mobile environment, where you have the ability to innovate faster? And if you get this right, and if the fast innovation creates a unique experience in your environment, you're probably going to want to make that available later to other providers as well. So I think it's an interesting opportunity.
What do you need from regulators to make the addressable advertising model work?
I think not from the regulators, but from the legislature, we got the first step, and that is, look, let's create a single playing field for everybody. Everybody should play by the same rules. Google, Apple, Facebook, AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon, Comcast should all play by the same rules as it relates to using customer data. We all ought to have the same opt-in requirements. We all ought to have the same aggregation requirements. So put everybody in the same playing field. And so the legislation that was passed and that President Trump signed is the first step. Now the regulators have to take it and put specific rules around it. But I think getting a first step, and that is everybody plays by the same rules, is critical. And this idea that somehow ISPs or wireless carriers have some unique advantage is bizarre at best. If you want to get to the Internet today, you got to go through one of two places, Android or iOS. And so to think that somehow ISPs are in a unique position to use customer data vis-a-vis these folks is not logical, candidly. And so trying to put everybody in the same level playing field, playing by the same rules, same opt-in procedures, we think is critical. So the first step's been taken.
Okay. Broadening out the regulatory side in Washington, you know, the FCC's been moving things around a little bit on Title II. How does that change the way you think about investing over the next 5 or 10 years?
You know, it goes so far beyond Title II. The FCC was headed down a path, by virtue of Title II, of hyper-regulation of virtually every facet of wireless and the broadband and the Internet industries. And just think about the regulations that were queued up coming into January. Regulation of business data services. By the way, that means business broadband pricing. So there was an effort underway to regulate how business broadband pricing is regulated. There was an effort underway on privacy, the things we were just talking about here. There are rules being queued up to be dealt with under this administration that would have treated ISPs radically different than Internet companies. There were rules queued up in terms of what was going to be permissible in terms of sponsored data, new business models, and so forth. I can go on, but there was a significant number of rules and regulations queued up under the guise of Title II, which was said from the very beginning Title II would not be used to regulate prices, which was laughable. It was obvious that Title II was going to be used to regulate prices. And so before inauguration transpired, all of those regulations that were queued up were gone. I mean, they were literally dead. And then the legislation on privacy, again, putting everybody on a level playing field, that legislation passed, signed by the president, and then Ajit Pai and the FCC last Thursday, the NPRM on Title II. There is an obvious move afoot saying that the wireless industry and the Internet industry being regulated under 1934 rules promulgated for a black dial telephone, that probably doesn't make much sense. That doesn't mean there should not be rules. We have said all along, I think virtually everybody in our industry has said all along, look, net neutrality, it's common sense. There should not be fast lanes and slow lanes. There should not be restriction of certain devices getting on these networks. There should not be throttling and so forth. Look, we all get that, and everybody agrees with that, but there's a better way to promulgate that than using a blunt hammer from 1934 that gives a regulator broad, pervasive purview over an entire ecosystem. And I don't think people appreciated just how much that was going to incorporate not just ISPs and telecom companies, but people in cloud service providers, people that are doing any kind of networking. It was a significant impact on an industry. And so I think we're probably headed down a more rational place. I do believe this is ultimately going to require some degree of regulation. Congress needs to move and just make it clear. What authority do we want the FCC to have? Do we want light touch regulation in a wireless industry and in an internet industry? If we do, promulgate rules. Let's make this really, really clear. I don't think the rules are that complex and that difficult. It ought to be doable, and hopefully we can get something done in the next 18 months.
Do you think we can get something done in this Congress?
I do. I think it's interesting. The rulemaking and the legislation on privacy, and if we do get Title II rolled back in the FCC, then all of a sudden I believe what that does is causes people in Congress to say, we need rules around this. Because now, you know, what rules do we want to oversee the internet and wireless? And I think we need to get really clear who owns what. Because today, it's not even clear which agency owns which particular provisions. Privacy, who owns that, FTC or FCC? So I do think that there'll be motivation on both sides of the aisle to get some legislation passed to bring some clarity to this.
What about the potential for tax reform and infrastructure bill this year?
A lot of people are getting pessimistic because of a lot of the noise in Washington right now that tax reform may not be achievable. I'm still optimistic, and I'm optimistic for a simple reason, that if you go to Washington and you visit with the Speaker of the House, I've done this recently, and you visit with people on the Democratic side of the aisle about, do we need corporate tax reform? You're hard-pressed to find somebody who would say no. You'll find somebody. But you're hard-pressed to find somebody who says, no, we think the corporate tax rate is just fine where it is. Being the highest corporate tax rate in the developed world is the right place for America to be. You can't find anybody to literally say that out loud. And so can we get something done? And I actually believe that you can get something done to bring the rates down. You're going to have to get rid of a lot of preferences and so forth, preferences that are dear to our industry, accelerated depreciation and so forth. That stuff's going to have to go away if you want to buy the rate down. But buying the rate down would have a massive impact, I believe, on economic growth and investment in this country. And when we are sitting here in the United States of America and corporate America is investing at the lowest level as a percentage of the economy since World War II, it tells you something's not right and something's broken. I believe what's broken is this. So bundling a tax reform with an infrastructure bill and territorialization of tax, I think, would be big. I think it's achievable. And I think if Congress were to pass it, I'm quite confident if Congress passes something, the president will sign it. So all that said, I'm optimistic something can still get done. So my fingers are crossed, and we're going to do our part to keep pushing this along.
Fingers crossed this year. So let's back up. You mentioned FirstNet earlier. Can you just update us on the process there and what's the sort of end game for when that gets done?
So the award, first of all, if you're not familiar with FirstNet, as a result of the 9/11 Commission, Congress passed a law that basically instructed the government to stand up an entity to put out a bid and to fund the build-out of a nationwide network for first responders, dedicated to first responders. And the government would fund the first investment in this, $6.5 billion. The government would invest to build this network. And whoever built the network would receive an allocation of 20 megahertz of 700 meg spectrum, premium spectrum. And so there was a bidding process, an RFP that went on, and AT&T was awarded the bid. So basically, the first $6.5 billion to build this nationwide network. And by the way, it's got to be nationwide, covering rural America and all of America, and it has to be a hardened network, meaning that it's all cell sites in hurricane areas are bunkered, that you have backup power on all cell sites, et cetera, et cetera. So it's got to be a hardened, redundant network, and it's got to be built over a five-year period of time. It comes with a spectrum. And to the extent that the first responders are not utilizing the spectrum, the company that has the rights to the spectrum can deploy it and use it for general commercial use. Okay, so that's kind of the deal, and that's what AT&T won. Government pays the first $6.5 billion. AT&T, we've committed $40 billion beyond that to building out this network. So, first of all, you get immediate access to the spectrum. That's a big deal. But you have to have, we call it a term we use as ruthless preemption capability, meaning if you're in this spectrum, if you have customers in this spectrum, and there is a demand by the first responder community, whether it's a national crisis or a local crisis or whatever, if there's demand, you have to ruthlessly preempt whoever's on that network, move them to another spectrum band, and give the first responders full access to that spectrum. So that work's done. We're ready to begin deploying. And we now are going into the process where we submit bids to all the states, and the states opt in or opt out. And the criterion for opting out are pretty stringent, and somebody's going to have to be really motivated to opt out. But we're fairly confident that we'll get this process moving in the next few days, weeks, and by year end, we'll be building this network in a number of states that have opted in early. There's a number of advantages that go with this. I mentioned the spectrum and access to the spectrum. That's a big darn deal. And the government was really smart in terms of how they constructed this proposal, because it really drove the value of the proposal up to the extent you could use that spectrum for general commercial use. There's another facet of it, which I've already mentioned, and that is we have another 40 megahertz of spectrum we're ready to put to use. To put it to use, you got to go put people up on cell towers, every cell tower across the country, and light up all that spectrum. You're going to be sending people up all these cell sites to deploy the FirstNet network. While they're on the cell sites, turn up the other 40 megahertz of spectrum. That was a really important benefit to us as well. And then last, this first responder community, police, fire departments, EMS departments, and so forth, we're underpenetrated in that market. The ability to build out this network, and there are penetration requirements inherent in the bid that we won, we're going to go into a market and actually gain share, we think, in a fairly quick fashion in an area where we're underpenetrated. So we're enthusiastic about that. Now think about first responder community. You've gone out and you've put everything from calling all cars to body cameras and car cameras and so forth to work. That becomes, if you will, an anchor tenant for smart connected cities. And you're in working with cities. You've got the technology turned up for the first responder community. Just beginning to move that into the connected city environment, we think, is a really great opportunity for us as well. So there are many layers to this thing that got us motivated and wanting to pursue this. And the more we got into it, the more enthusiastic we got. The government did a very good job of adjusting the bid so that it really drove the right behaviors by all the bidders and created a really high-value proposition for the governments as well as for the companies that came in and bid on it.
You've talked about a five-year time frame allowed to build this, but I would think you front-load a lot of that as fast as you can.
We want to go as fast as we possibly can go. And to the extent we get the states opting in, this should not be a five-year build. We ought to be able to do this much quicker than that, and we're motivated to do it quicker than that.
And are there states that are sort of prepared to opt in once all the things are done? We don't
have
to wait to the end?
You might guess, I've spoken to a number of governors around the states, and they're anxious to engage on this. Governors, particularly governors in states that are prone to natural disasters and so forth, are very enthusiastic to get going on this. So we think there are some states that will opt in fairly quickly. And we'll get going. There's also a recognition that you invest in this kind of infrastructure, it just inherently creates jobs. And we have disclosed that over the next 2 years alone, deploying this network will require us to add 10,000 people. We'll hire between us and contractors and cell site climbers and so forth, 10,000 people. And those states that go early are going to see those jobs first. So there's a desire by many of the governors to get it going for that reason as well.
You mentioned this, how this plays into the Smart City Initiative. What's your plan on 5G, and how does that play into Smart City?
So 5G, the process is in place now. The standards are being set, and we're not too enthusiastic about pursuing a non-standard approach. Every time we've gone down that path, we've regretted it. So we've been actively working with others in the industry to bring the standard-setting process forward. We've accelerated it by a full year. So we like where the standard-setting process is. And so what are the elements you need to deploy 5G? I've already gone through it, right? Dense fiber footprint. And we love our position on fiber, so you can kind of check that one off. We'll have to deploy more fiber in some areas where we don't have the dense footprint. This city would be one. We're going to have to deploy more fiber or buy more fiber. And there's a few pockets around the U.S. where we'll have to do that. The spectrum is a huge element to this. And the early standards are purely on millimeter wave spectrum. And so deploying 5G is going to require millimeter wave spectrum if you're going to take a standards approach. Otherwise, you're looking at 2020, 2021 before you're deploying what we call true 5G. With the one full gig capability, not theoretical, but one gig capabilities. And so acquiring the millimeter wave footprint was critical. Having a nationwide footprint was absolutely critical. And so we're doing trials now. We're in the market. We're doing trials. We've got an evolution path to get us to a full 5G technology deployment. Late 2018, we'll do it on a fixed basis, meaning to the home, not a mobile basis, because there won't be any handsets probably till 2019. But doing fixed solutions, I got to tell you, I'm very enthusiastic about deploying fiber to the home. We like to say it's a bit like chasing taillights. You want it out there. We're going to keep going harder. But a 5G deployment to the home is a way to leapfrog technologically a true gigabit type service into the home and into the business. And so we're motivated on this on several levels. We want the mobility solution to delivering premium media content and entertainment, but also a robust broadband offering into the home and business that doesn't require taking fiber all the way into the home. You can use wireless for the last 200 meters, 300 meters or so. And so there are a lot of reasons we want to go hard on this, and we think we've got all the piece parts in place. We think we've got the standards bodies moving. We got the vendors developing hardware, and handset developers are busy creating the handsets for this as well. So like where we are.
So you talked about 5G and mobile world as a fixed replacement technology. What about the sort of next generation business models that could come of that? Whether it's IoT or smart city, which you mentioned.
Yeah, IoT and smart city is the easy ones. Those are the ones that you conceive of really, really quickly. And what are really bursty type applications that require really low latency and high bandwidth, right? So you just said it. Smart cities, IoT. But the other areas that get you really enthused that are going to require massive bandwidth over time are first and foremost autonomous cars. And you go visit with the folks at Zoox or Mobileye, and you sit down with them, and you very quickly begin to understand that a world of autonomous cars where you want to turn this up and truly have that type of capability, you're talking about 1 gigabyte per car per mile to make that a reality. That doesn't happen in current technology configurations. That is a 5G millimeter wave world where you have that type of capacity and capability. So we think it's vitally important to get to a world of autonomous cars and autonomous driving. World of virtual reality. You can go look at any of the virtual reality applications that are out there. They're going to continue to get better and better. We're at maybe even Rev 1.5. I think Rev 3 of virtual reality technology, when it takes off, is going to take off in a big way. Put it with augmented reality, we think there are some really exciting things for business application as well as consumer application. In the world of media and entertainment, guys like Steven Spielberg run in place when they think of virtual and augmented reality and how it influences the media and the entertainment business. So if you think it's going to take off in the world of media and entertainment, then you want a network configuration that can drive it. We think wireless is critical. That's why we think 5G is the more than home broadband. 5G will be the big driver of allowing virtual reality to truly take off. And you can just keep going. Obviously, autonomous taxis, air taxis and so forth, that's going to require a world of 5G as well. And there's just so many areas, drones, huge capacity requirements in all of this.
Fun. We're out of time. Thank you very much.
Enjoyed being with you.
See you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
You bet.